Ron took their copies of Unfogging the Future back down to the common room, found a table, and set to work on their predictions for the coming month. An hour later, they had made very little progress, though their table was littered with bits of parchment bearing sums and symbols, and Harry's brain was as fogged as though it had been filled with the fumes from Professor Trelawney's fire. "I haven't got a clue what this lot's supposed to mean," he said, staring down at a long list of calculations. "You know," said Ron, whose hair was on end because of all the times he had run his fingers through it in frustration, "I think it's back to the old divination standby."
"What? Make it up?"
"Yeah," said Ron, sweeping the jumble of scrawled notes off the table, dipping his pen into some ink, and starting to write. "Next Monday," he said as he scribbled, "I am likely to develop a cough, owing to the unlucky conjunction of Mars and Jupiter." He looked up at Harry. "You know her. Just put in loads of misery. She'll lap it up." "Right," said Harry, crumpling up his first attempt and lobbing it over the heads of a group of chattering first years into the fire. "Okay. On Monday, I will be in danger of burns."
"Yeah, you will be," said Ron darkly.
"We're seeing the scroots again on Monday. Okay, Tuesday. I'll, lose a treasured possession," said Harry, who was flicking through Unfogging the Future for ideas. "Good one," said Ron, copying it down. "Because of, Mercury. Why don't you get stabbed in the back by someone you thought was a friend?"
"Yeah, cool," said Harry, scribbling it down.
"Because Venus is in the 12th house. And on Wednesday I think I'll come off worst in a fight."
"Ah, I was going to have a fight. Okay, I'll lose a bet."
"Yeah, you'll be betting I'll win my fight." They continued to make up predictions, which grew steadily more tragic, for another hour, while the common room around them slowly emptied as people went up to bed. Crookshanks wandered over to them, leapt lightly into an empty chair, and stared inscrutably at Harry, rather as Hermione might look if she knew they weren't doing their homework properly. Staring around the room, trying to think of a kind of misfortune he hadn't yet used, Harry saw Fred and George sitting together against the opposite wall, heads together, quills out, poring over a single piece of parchment. It was most unusual to see Fred and George hidden away in a corner and working silently. They usually liked to be in the thick of things and the noisy centre of attention. There was something secretive about the way they were working on the piece of parchment, and Harry was reminded of how they had sat together writing something back at the Burrow. He had thought then that it was another order form for Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, but it didn't look like that this time. If it had been, they would surely have let Lee Jordan in on the joke. He wondered whether it had anything to do with entering the Tri-Wizard tournament. As Harry watched, George shook his head at Fred, scratched out something with his quill, and said, in a very quiet voice that nevertheless carried across the almost deserted room,
"No, that sounds like we're accusing him. Got to be careful."
Then George looked over and saw Harry watching him. Harry grinned and quickly returned to his predictions. He didn't want George to think he was eavesdropping. Shortly after that, the twins rolled up their parchment, said good night, and went off to bed. Fred and George had been gone 10 minutes or so when the portrait hole opened, and Hermione climbed into the common room, carrying a sheaf of parchment in one hand and a box whose contents rattled as she walked in the other. Crookshanks arched his back, purring.
"Hello," she said. "I've just finished."
"So have I," said Ron, triumphantly throwing down his quill. Hermione sat down, laid the thing she was carrying in an empty armchair, and pulled Ron's predictions toward her.
"Not going to have a very good month, are you?" she said sardonically as Crookshanks curled up in her lap.
"Oh, well, at least I'm forewarned," Ron yawned.
"You seem to be drowning twice," said Hermione.
"Oh, am I?"
said Ron, peering down at his predictions.
I'd better change one of them to getting trampled by a rampaging hippogriff.
Don't you think it's a bit obvious you've made these up? Said Hermione.
How dare you? Said Ron in mock outrage. We've been working like house elves here.
Hermione raised her eyebrows.
It's just an expression, said Ron hastily.
Harry laid down his quill too, having just finished predicting his own death by decapitation.
What's in the box? He asked, pointing at it.
Funny you should ask, said Hermione with a nasty look at Ron. She took off the lid and showed them the contents.
Inside were about 50 badges, all of different colours, but all bearing the same letters, S-P-E-W.
Spew? Said Harry, picking up a badge and looking at it. What's this about?
Not spew, said Hermione impatiently. It's S-P-E-W, stands for the Society for the Promotion of Elfish Welfare.
Never heard of it, said Ron.
Well, of course you haven't, said Hermione briskly. I've only just started it.
Yeah? Said Ron in mild surprise. How many members have you got?
Well, if you two join...
Three, said Hermione.
And you think we want to walk around wearing badges saying spew, do you? Said Ron. S-P-E-W, said Hermione hotly. I was going to put... Stop the outrageous abuse of our fellow magical creatures and campaign for a change in their legal status, but it wouldn't fit. So, that's the heading of our manifesto.
She brandished the sheaf of parchment at them.
I've been researching it thoroughly in the library. Elf enslavement goes back centuries. I can't believe no one's done anything about it before now.
Hermione, open your ears! Said Ron loudly.
They like it. They like being enslaved.
Our short-term aims, said Hermione, speaking even more loudly than Ron, and acting as though she hadn't heard a word, are to secure house elves fair wages and working conditions. Our long-term aims include changing the law about non-wand use and trying to get an elf into the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures, because they're shockingly underrepresented.
And how do we do all this? Harry asked.
We start by recruiting members, said Hermione happily. I thought 2 sickles to join. That buys a badge, and the proceeds can fund our leaflet campaign. You're treasurer, Ron. I've got you a collecting tin upstairs, and Harry, you're secretary, so you might want to write down everything I'm saying now as a record of our first meeting.
There was a pause in which Hermione beamed at the pair of them, and Harry sat, torn between exasperation at Hermione and amusement at the look on Ron's face. The silence was broken, not by Ron, who in any case looked as though he was temporarily dumbstruck, but by a soft tap-tap on the window. Harry looked across the now empty common room and saw, illuminated by the moonlight, a snowy owl perched on the windowsill.
Hedwig!
He shouted, and he launched himself out of his chair and across the room to pull open the window. Hedwig flew inside, soared across the room, and landed on the table on top of Harry's predictions.
"About time," said Harry, hurrying after her. "She's got an answer," said Ron excitedly, pointing at the grubby piece of parchment tied to Hedwig's leg.
Harry hastily untied it and sat down to read, whereupon Hedwig fluttered onto his knee, hooting softly.
"What does it say?"
Hermione asked breathlessly. The letter was very short, and looked as though it had been scrawled in a great hurry. Harry read it aloud. "Harry, I'm flying north immediately. This news about your scar is the latest in a series of strange rumours that have reached me here. If it hurts again, go straight to Dumbledore. They're saying he's got Mad-Eye out of retirement, which means he's reading the signs, even if no one else is. I'll be in touch soon. My best to Ron and Hermione. Keep your eyes open, Harry. Sirius." Harry looked up at Ron and Hermione, who stared back at him.
"He's flying north?" Hermione whispered. "He's coming back?"
"Dumbledore's reading what signs?" said Ron, looking perplexed. "Harry, what's up?"
For Harry had just hit himself in the forehead with his fist, jolting Hedwig out of his lap.
"I shouldn't have told him," Harry said furiously.
"What are you on about?" said Ron in surprise. "It's made him think he's got to come back," said Harry, now slamming his fist on the table so that Hedwig landed on the back of Ron's chair, hooting indignantly. "Coming back because he thinks I'm in trouble and there's nothing wrong with me and I haven't got anything for you." Harry snapped at Hedwig, who was clicking her beak expectantly. "You'll have to go up to the owlry if you want food." Hedwig gave him an extremely offended look and took off for the open window, cuffing him around the head with her outstretched wing as she went. "Harry," Hermione began in a pacifying sort of voice. "I'm going to bed," said Harry shortly. "See you in the morning." Upstairs in the dormitory, he pulled on his pajamas and got into his four-poster, but he didn't feel remotely tired. If Sirius came back and got caught, it would be his, Harry's, fault. Why hadn't he kept his mouth shut? A few seconds' pain and he'd had to blab. If he just had the sense to keep it to himself. He heard Ron come up into the dormitory a short while later, but did not speak to him. For a long time, Harry lay staring up at the dark canopy of his bed. The dormitory was completely silent, and, had he been less preoccupied, Harry would have realized that the absence of Neville's usual snores meant that he was not the only one lying awake. Chapter 15 Beaubaton and Durmstrang. Early next morning, Harry woke with a plan fully formed in his mind, as though his sleeping brain had been working on it all night. He got up, dressed in the pale dawn light, left the dormitory without waking Ron, and went back down to the deserted common room. Here he took a piece of parchment from the table, upon which his divination homework still lay, and wrote the following letter. "Dear Sirius, I reckon I just imagined my scar hurting. I was half asleep when I wrote to you last time. There's no point coming back. Everything's fine here. Don't worry about me. My head feels completely normal. Harry." He then climbed out of the portrait hole, up through the silent castle, held up only briefly by Peeves, who tried to overturn a large vase on him halfway along the fourth-floor corridor, finally arriving at the owlry, which was situated at the top of West Tower. The owlry was a circular stone room, rather cold and draughty, because none of the windows had glass in them. The floor was entirely covered in straw, owl droppings, and the regurgitated skeletons of mice and voles. Hundreds upon hundreds of owls of every breed imaginable were nestled here on perches that rose right up to the top of the tower, nearly all of them asleep, though here and there a round amber eye glared at Harry. He spotted Hedwig nestled between a barn owl and a tawny, and hurried over to her, sliding a little on the dropping-strewn floor. It took him a while to persuade her to wake up and then to look at him, as she kept shuffling around on her perch, showing him her tail. She was evidently still furious about his lack of gratitude the previous night. In the end, it was Harry suggesting she might be too tired, and that perhaps he would ask Ron to borrow Pigwidgeon, that made her stick out her leg and allow him to tie the letter to it. "Just find him, all right?" Harry said, stroking her back as he carried her on his arm to one of the holes in the wall. "Before the Dementors do." She nipped his finger, perhaps rather harder than she would ordinarily have done, but hooted softly in a reassuring sort of way all the same. Then she spread her wings and took off into the sunrise. Harry watched her fly out of sight with a familiar feeling of unease back in his stomach. He had been so sure that Sirius's reply would alleviate his worries rather than increasing them. "That was a lie, Harry," said Hermione sharply over breakfast, when he told her and Ron what he had done. "You didn't imagine your scar hurting, and you know it." "So what?" said Harry. "He's not going back to Azkaban because of me." "Drop it," said Ron sharply to Hermione as she opened her mouth to argue some more, and for once Hermione heeded him and fell silent. Harry did his best not to worry about Sirius over the next couple of weeks. True, he could not stop himself from looking anxiously around every morning when the post-owls arrived, nor, late at night before he went to sleep, prevent himself from seeing horrible visions of Sirius, cornered by Dementors down some dark London street, but between times he tried to keep his mind off his godfather. He wished he still had Quidditch to distract him. Nothing works so well on a troubled mind as a good, hard training session. On the other hand, their lessons were becoming more difficult and demanding than ever before, particularly Moody's defense against the dark arts. To their surprise, Professor Moody had announced that he would be putting the imperious curse on each of them in turn, to demonstrate its power and to see whether they could resist its effects.
"But you said it's illegal, Professor,"
said Hermione uncertainly, as Moody cleared away the desks with a sweep of his wand, leaving a large clear space in the middle of the room.
"You said to use it against another human was—"
"Dumbledore wants you taught what it feels like," said Moody, his magical eyes swiveling onto Hermione and fixing her with an eerie, unblinking stare. "If you'd rather learn the hard way, when someone's putting it on you so they can control you completely, fine, by me, you're excused. Off you go."
He pointed one gnarled finger toward the door. Hermione went very pink and muttered something about not meaning that she wanted to leave. Harry and Ron grinned at each other. They knew Hermione would rather eat boobo-tuber pus than to miss such an important lesson. Moody began to beckon students forward in turn and put the imperious curse upon them. Harry watched as, one by one, his classmates did the most extraordinary things under its influence. Dean Thomas hopped three times around the room, singing the national anthem. Lavender Brown imitated a squirrel. Neville performed a series of quite astonishing gymnastics he would certainly not have been capable of in his normal state. Not one of them seemed to be able to fight off the curse, and each of them recovered only when Moody had removed it.
"Potter," Moody growled, "you next."
Harry moved forward into the middle of the classroom, into the space that Moody had cleared of desks. Moody raised his wand, pointed it at Harry, and said,
"Imperio."
It was the most wonderful feeling. Harry felt a floating sensation as every thought and worry in his head was wiped gently away, leaving nothing but a vague, untraceable happiness. He stood there feeling immensely relaxed, only dimly aware of everyone watching him. And then he heard Mad-Eye Moody's voice, echoing in some distant chamber of his empty brain.
"Jump onto the desk! Jump onto the desk!"
Harry bent his knees obediently, preparing to spring.
"Jump onto the desk!"
Why, though? Another voice had awoken in the back of his brain.
"Stupid thing to do, really," said the voice.
"Jump onto the desk!"
"No, I don't think I will, thanks," said the other voice, a little more firmly. "No, I don't really want to.
Jump now!"
The next thing Harry felt was considerable pain. He had both jumped and tried to prevent himself from jumping. The result was that he'd smashed headlong into the desk, knocking it over, and, by the feeling in his legs, fractured both his kneecaps.
"Now, that's more like it," growled Moody's voice,
and suddenly Harry felt the empty, echoing feeling in his head disappear. He remembered exactly what was happening, and the pain in his knees seemed to double.
"Look at that, you lot. Potter fought. He fought it, and he damn near beat it. We'll try that again, Potter, and the rest of you, pay attention. Watch his eyes. That's where you see it. Very good, Potter. Very good indeed. They'll have trouble controlling you."
"The way he talks," Harry muttered as he hobbled out of the Defense Against the Dark Arts class an hour later.
Moody had insisted on putting Harry through his paces four times in a row until Harry could throw off the curse entirely.
"You'd think we were all going to be attacked any second."
"Yeah, I know,"
said Ron, who was skipping on every alternate step. He had had much more difficulty with the curse than Harry, though Moody assured him the effects would wear off by lunchtime.
Talk about paranoid!
Ron glanced nervously over his shoulder to check that Moody was definitely out of earshot, and went on,
No wonder they were glad to get shot of him at the ministry. Did you hear him tell Seamus what he did to that witch who shouted boo behind him on April Fool's Day? And when are we supposed to read up on resisting the imperious curse with everything else we've got to do?
All the fourth years had noticed a definite increase in the amount of work they were required to do this term. Professor McGonagall explained why, when the class gave a particularly loud groan at the amount of transfiguration homework she had assigned.
You are now entering a most important phase of your magical education, she told them, her eyes glinting dangerously behind her square spectacles. Your ordinary wizarding levels are drawing closer.
We don't take OWLs till fifth year, said Dean Thomas indignantly.
Maybe not, Thomas, but believe me, you need all the preparation you can get. Miss Granger remains the only person in this class who has managed to turn a hedgehog into a satisfactory pincushion. I must remind you that your pincushion, Thomas, still curls up in fright if anyone approaches it with a pin.
Hermione, who had turned rather pink again, seemed to be trying not to look too pleased with herself. Harry and Ron were deeply amused when Professor Trelawney told them that they had received top marks for their homework in their next divination class. She read out large portions of their predictions, commending them for their unflinching acceptance of the horrors in store for them. But they were less amused when she asked them to do the same thing for the month after next. Both of them were running out of ideas for catastrophes. Meanwhile, Professor Binns, the ghost who taught history of magic, had them writing weekly essays on the goblin rebellions of the 18th century. Professor Snape was forcing them to research antidotes. They took this one seriously, as he had hinted that he might be poisoning one of them before Christmas to see if their antidote worked. Professor Flitwick had asked them to read three extra books in preparation for their lesson on summoning charms. Even Hagrid was adding to their workload. The blast-ended scroots were growing at a remarkable pace, given that nobody had yet discovered what they ate. Hagrid was delighted, and, as part of their project, suggested that they come down to his hut on alternate evenings to observe the scroots and make notes on their extraordinary behaviour.
"I will not," said Draco Malfoy flatly when Hagrid had proposed this with the air of Father Christmas pulling an extra-large toy out of his sack. "I see enough of these foul things during lessons, thanks."
Hagrid's smile faded off his face.
"You'll do what you're told," he growled, "or I'll be taking a leaf out of Professor Moody's book. I hear you made a good ferret, Malfoy."
The Gryffindors roared with laughter. Malfoy flushed with anger, but apparently the memory of Moody's punishment was still sufficiently painful to stop him from retorting. Harry, Ron, and Hermione returned to the castle at the end of the lesson in high spirits. Seeing Hagrid put down Malfoy was particularly satisfying, especially because Malfoy had done his very best to get Hagrid sacked the previous year. When they arrived in the entrance hall, they found themselves unable to proceed, owing to a large crowd of students congregated there, all milling around a large sign that had been erected at the foot of the marble staircase. Ron, the tallest of the three, stood on tiptoe to see over the heads in front of them, and read the sign aloud to the other two.
"Triwizard Tournament! The delegations from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang will be arriving at 6 o'clock on Friday the 30th of October. Lessons will end half an hour early."
"Brilliant," said Harry. "It's potions last thing on Friday. Snape won't have time to poison us all."
"Students will return their bags and books to their dormitories and assemble in front of the castle to greet our guests before the welcoming feast."
"Only a week away?"
said Ernie Macmillan of Hufflepuff, emerging from the crowd, his eyes gleaming.
"I wonder if Cedric knows. Think I'll go and tell him."
"Cedric?"
said Ron blankly, as Ernie hurried off.
"Diggory," said Harry. "He must be entering the tournament."
"That idiot Hogwarts champion!"
said Ron as they pushed their way through the chattering crowd toward the staircase.
"He's not an idiot. You just don't like him because he beat Gryffindor at Quidditch," said Hermione. "I've heard he's a really good student, and he's a prefect."
She spoke as though this settled the matter.
"You only like him because he's handsome," said Ron scathingly. "Excuse me, I don't like people just because they're handsome," said Hermione indignantly.
Ron gave a loud false cough, which sounded oddly like Lockhart. The appearance of the sign in the entrance hall had a marked effect upon the inhabitants of the castle. During the following week, there seemed to be only one topic of conversation no matter where Harry went, the Triwizard Tournament. Rumours were flying from student to student like highly contagious germs. Who was going to try for Hogwarts champion, what the tournament would involve, how the students from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang differed from themselves. Harry noticed, too, that the castle seemed to be undergoing an extra thorough cleaning. Several grimy portraits had been scrubbed, much to the displeasure of their subjects, who sat huddled in their frames, muttering darkly and wincing as they felt their raw pink faces. The suits of armour were suddenly gleaming and moving without squeaking, and Argus Filch, the caretaker, was behaving so ferociously to any students who forgot to wipe their shoes that he terrified a pair of first-year girls into hysterics. Other members of the staff seemed oddly tense, too.
"Longbottom, kindly do not reveal that you can't even perform a simple switching spell in front of anyone from Durmstrang,"
Professor McGonagall barked at the end of one particularly difficult lesson, during which Neville had accidentally transplanted his own ears onto a cactus. When they went down to breakfast on the morning of the 30th of October, they found that the great hall had been decorated overnight. Enormous silk banners hung from the walls, each of them representing a Hogwarts house. Red with a gold lion for Gryffindor, blue with a bronze eagle for Ravenclaw, yellow with a black badger for Hufflepuff, and green with a silver serpent for Slytherin. Behind the teacher's table, the largest banner of all bore the Hogwarts coat of arms. Lion, eagle, badger, and snake united around a large letter H. Harry, Ron, and Hermione sat down beside Fred and George at the Gryffindor table. Once again, and most unusually, they were sitting apart from everyone else and conversing in low voices. Ron led the way over to them.
"It's a bummer, all right," George was saying gloomily to Fred. "But if he won't talk to us in person, we'll have to send him the letter after all. Or we'll stuff it into his hand. He can't avoid us forever." "Who's avoiding you?" said Ron, sitting down next to them.
"Wish you would," said Fred, looking irritated at the interruption.
"What's a bummer?" Ron asked George. "Having a nosy git like you for a brother," said George.
"You two got any ideas on the Triwizard Tournament yet?" Harry asked. "Thought any more about trying to enter?"
"I asked McGonagall how the champions are chosen, but she wasn't telling," said George bitterly. "She just told me to shut up and get on with transfiguring my raccoon." "Wonder what the tasks are going to be," said Ron thoughtfully. "You know, I bet we could do them, Harry. We've done dangerous stuff before."
"Not in front of a panel of judges, you haven't," said Fred. "McGonagall says the champions get awarded points according to how well they've done the tasks."
"Who are the judges?" Harry asked. "Well, the heads of the participating schools are always on the panel," said Hermione,
and everyone looked around at her, rather surprised.
"Because all three of them were injured during the tournament of 1792, when a cockatrice the champions were supposed to be catching went on the rampage."
She noticed them all looking at her and said, with her usual air of impatience that nobody else had read all the books she had,
"It's all in Hogwarts, a history. Though, of course, that book's not entirely reliable. A revised history of Hogwarts would be a more accurate title. Or a highly biased and selective history of Hogwarts, which glosses over the nastier aspects of the school."
"What are you on about?"
said Ron, though Harry thought he knew what was coming.
"House elves,"
said Hermione, her eyes flashing. Not once in over 1,000 pages does Hogwarts, a history, mention that we are all colluding in the oppression of 100 slaves.
Harry shook his head and applied himself to his scrambled eggs. His and Ron's lack of enthusiasm had done nothing whatsoever to curb Hermione's determination to pursue justice for house elves. True, both of them had paid 2 sickles for an SPEW badge, but they had only done it to keep her quiet. Their sickles had been wasted, however. If anything, they seemed to have made Hermione more vociferous. She had been badgering Harry and Ron ever since, first to wear the badges, then to persuade others to do the same. And she had also taken to rattling around the Gryffindor common room every evening, cornering people and shaking the collecting tin under their noses.
"You do realize that your sheets are changed, your fires lit, your classrooms cleaned, and your food cooked by a group of magical creatures who are unpaid and enslaved?"
she kept saying fiercely. Some people like Neville had paid up just to stop Hermione from glowering at them. A few seemed mildly interested in what she had to say, but were reluctant to take a more active role in campaigning. Many regarded the whole thing as a joke. Ron now rolled his eyes at the ceiling, which was flooding them all in autumn sunlight, and Fred became extremely interested in his bacon. Both twins had refused to buy an SPEW badge. George, however, leaned in towards Hermione.
"Listen, have you ever been down in the kitchens, Hermione?"
"No, of course not," said Hermione curtly. "I hardly think students are supposed to—"
"Well, we have," said George, indicating Fred, "loads of times, to nick food. And we've met them, and they're happy. They think they've got the best job in the world."
"That's because they're uneducated and brainwashed," Hermione began hotly, but her next few words were drowned out by the sudden whooshing noise from overhead, which announced the arrival of the post-owls.
Harry looked up at once and saw Hedwig soaring toward him. Hermione stopped talking abruptly. She and Ron watched Hedwig anxiously as she fluttered down onto Harry's shoulder, folded her wings, and held out her leg wearily. Harry pulled off Sirius's reply and offered Hedwig his bacon rinds, which she ate gratefully. Then, checking that Fred and George were safely immersed in further discussions about the Tri-Wizard Tournament, Harry read out Sirius's letter in a whisper to Ron and Hermione.
"Nice try, Harry. I'm back in the country and well hidden. I want you to keep me posted on everything that's going on at Hogwarts. Don't use Hedwig. Keep changing owls. And don't worry about me. Just watch out for yourself. Don't forget what I said about your scar. Sirius."
"Why do you have to keep changing owls?"
Ron asked in a low voice.
"Hedwig will attract too much attention," said Hermione at once. "She stands out. A snowy owl that keeps returning to wherever he's hiding. I mean, they're not native birds, are they?"
Harry rolled up the letter and slipped it inside his robes, wondering whether he felt more or less worried than before. He supposed that Sirius managing to get back without being caught was something. He couldn't deny either that the idea that Sirius was much nearer was reassuring. At least he wouldn't have to wait so long for a response every time he wrote.
"Thanks, Hedwig," he said, stroking her.
She hooted sleepily, dipped her beak briefly into his goblet of orange juice, then took off again, clearly desperate for a good long sleep in the owlry. There was a pleasant feeling of anticipation in the air that day. Nobody was very attentive in lessons, being much more interested in the arrival that evening of the people from Beauxbatons and Durmstrang. Even potions was more bearable than usual, as it was half an hour shorter. When the bell rang early, Harry, Ron, and Hermione hurried up to Gryffindor Tower, deposited their bags and books as they had been instructed, pulled on their cloaks, and rushed back downstairs into the entrance hall. The heads of houses were ordering their students into lines.
"Weasley, straighten your hat," Professor McGonagall snapped at Ron. "Miss Patel, take that ridiculous thing out of your hair."
Parvati scowled and removed a large ornamental butterfly from the end of her plait.
"Follow me, please," said Professor McGonagall. "First year's in front. No pushing."
They filed down the steps and lined up in front of the castle. It was a cold, clear evening. Dusk was falling, and a pale, transparent-looking moon was already shining over the forbidden forest. Harry, standing between Ron and Hermione in the fourth row from the front, saw Dennis Creevy positively shivering with anticipation among the other first years.
"Nearly six," said Ron, checking his watch and then staring down the drive that led to the front gates.
"How do you reckon they're coming? The train?"
"I doubt it," said Hermione.
"How then? Broomsticks?"
Harry suggested, looking up at the starry sky.
"I don't think so. Not from that far away."
"A portkey," Ron suggested.
"Or they could apparate.
Maybe you're allowed to do it under 17, wherever they come from."
"You can't apparate inside the Hogwarts grounds. How often do I have to tell you?"
said Hermione impatiently. They scanned the darkening grounds excitedly, but nothing was moving. Everything was still silent and quite as usual. Harry was starting to feel cold. He wished they'd hurry up. Maybe the foreign students were preparing a dramatic entrance. He remembered what Mr. Weasley had said back at the campsite before the Quidditch World Cup.
"Always the same. We can't resist showing off when we get together."
And then Dumbledore called out from the back row where he stood with the other teachers.
"Aha! Unless I am very much mistaken, the delegation from Beauxbatons approaches."
"Where?"
said many students eagerly, all looking in different directions.
"There!"
yelled a sixth year, pointing over the forest. Something large, much larger than a broomstick, or indeed 100 broomsticks, was hurtling across the deep blue sky toward the castle, growing larger all the time.
"It's a dragon!"
shrieked one of the first years, losing her head completely.
"Don't be stupid! It's a flying house!" said Dennis Creevy.
Dennis's guess was closer. As the gigantic black shape skimmed over the treetops of the Forbidden Forest, and the lights shining from the castle windows hit it, they saw a gigantic powder-blue horse-drawn carriage, the size of a large house, soaring toward them. Pulled through the air by a dozen winged horses, all palominos, and each the size of an elephant. The front three rows of students drew backward as the carriage hurtled ever lower, coming in to land at a tremendous speed. Then, with an almighty crash that made Neville jump backward onto a Slytherin fifth year's foot, the horse's hooves, larger than dinner plates, hit the ground. A second later, the carriage landed too, bouncing upon its vast wheels, while the golden horses tossed their enormous heads and rolled large, fiery red eyes. Harry just had time to see that the door of the carriage bore a coat of arms, two crossed golden wands, each emitting three stars, before it opened. A boy in pale blue robes jumped down from the carriage, bent forward, fumbled for a moment with something on the carriage floor, and unfolded a set of golden steps. He sprang back respectfully. Then Harry saw a shining, high-heeled black shoe emerging from the inside of the carriage, a shoe the size of a child's sled, followed almost immediately by the largest woman he had ever seen in his life. The size of the carriage and of the horses was immediately explained. A few people gasped. Harry had only ever seen one person as large as this woman in his life, and that was Hagrid. He doubted whether there was an inch difference in their heights, yet somehow, maybe simply because he was used to Hagrid, this woman, now at the foot of the steps and looking around at the waiting, wide-eyed crowd, seemed even more unnaturally large. As she stepped into the light flooding from the entrance hall, she was revealed to have a handsome, olive-skinned face, large, black, liquid-looking eyes, and a rather beaky nose. Her hair was drawn back in a shining knob at the base of her neck. She was dressed from head to foot in black satin, and many magnificent opals gleamed at her throat and on her thick fingers. Dumbledore started to clap. The students, following his lead, broke into applause too, many of them standing on tiptoe, the better to look at this woman. Her face relaxed into a gracious smile, and she walked forward toward Dumbledore, extending a glittering hand. Dumbledore, though tall himself, had barely to bend to kiss it.
"My dear Madam Maxine," he said, "welcome to Hogwarts."
"Dumbledore," said Madam Maxine in a deep voice, "I hope I find you well."
"In excellent form, I thank you," said Dumbledore.
"My pupils," said Madame Maxime, waving one of her enormous hands carelessly behind her.
Harry, whose attention had been focused completely upon Madame Maxime, now noticed that about a dozen boys and girls, all, by the look of them, in their late teens, had emerged from the carriage and were now standing behind Madame Maxime. They were shivering, which was unsurprising, given that their robes seemed to be made of fine silk, and none of them were wearing cloaks. A few had wrapped scarves and shawls around their heads. From what Harry could see of them, they were standing in Madame Maxime's enormous shadow, they were staring up at Hogwarts with apprehensive looks on their faces.
"Has Karkaroff arrived yet?"
Madame Maxime asked.
"He should be here any moment," said Dumbledore. "Would you like to wait here and greet him, or would you prefer to step inside and warm up a trifle?"
"Warm up, I think," said Madame Maxime. "But the horses?"
"Our care of magical creatures, teacher, will be delighted to take care of them," said Dumbledore, "the moment he has returned from dealing with a slight situation that has arisen with some of his other, charges."
"Scroots," Ron muttered to Harry, grinning. "My steeds require, forceful handling," said Madame Maxime, looking as though she doubted whether any care of magical creatures teacher at Hogwarts could be up to the job.
"They are very strong." "I assure you that Hagrid will be well up to the job," said Dumbledore, smiling.
"Very well," said Madame Maxime, bowing slightly. "Will you please inform this Hagrid that the horses drink only single malt whiskey?"
"It will be attended to," said Dumbledore, also bowing.
"Come," said Madame Maxime imperiously to her students, and the Hogwarts crowd parted to allow her and her students to pass up the stone steps.
"How big do you reckon Durmstrang's horses are going to be?" Seamus Finnegan said, leaning around Lavender and Parvati to address Harry and Ron.
"Well, if they're any bigger than this lot, even Hagrid won't be able to handle them," said Harry. "That's if he hasn't been attacked by his scroots. Wonder what's up with them. Maybe they've escaped," said Ron, hopefully.
"Ooh, don't say that," said Hermione with a shudder. "Imagine that lot loose on the grounds."
They stood shivering slightly now, waiting for the Durmstrang party to arrive. Most people were gazing hopefully up at the sky. For a few minutes, the silence was broken only by Madame Maxime's huge horses snorting and stamping, but then...
"Can you hear something?" said Ron suddenly.
Harry listened. A loud and oddly eerie noise was drifting toward them from out of the darkness, a muffled rumbling and sucking sound, as though an immense vacuum cleaner were moving along a riverbed.
"The lake!"
yelled Lee Jordan, pointing down at it.
"Look at the lake!"
From their position at the top of the lawns overlooking the grounds, they had a clear view of the smooth, black surface of the water, except that the surface was suddenly not smooth at all. Some disturbance was taking place deep in the centre. Great bubbles were forming on the surface. Waves were now washing over the muddy banks. And then, out in the very middle of the lake, a whirlpool appeared, as if a giant plug had just been pulled out of the lake's floor. What seemed to be a long, black pole began to rise slowly out of the heart of the whirlpool, and then Harry saw the rigging.
"It's a mast," he said to Ron and Hermione.
Slowly, magnificently, the ship rose out of the water, gleaming in the moonlight. It had a strangely skeletal look about it, as though it were a resurrected wreck, and the dim, misty lights shimmering at its portholes looked like ghostly eyes. Finally, with a great sloshing noise, the ship emerged entirely, bobbing on the turbulent water, and began to glide toward the bank. A few moments later, they heard the splash of an anchor being thrown down in the shallows and the thud of a plank being lowered onto the bank. People were disembarking. They could see their silhouettes passing the lights in the ship's portholes. All of them, Harry noticed, seemed to be built along the lines of crab and goyle. But then, as they drew nearer, walking up the lawns into the light streaming from the entrance hall, he saw that their bulk was really due to the fact that they were wearing cloaks of some kind of shaggy, matted fur. But the man who was leading them up to the castle was wearing furs of a different sort, sleek and silver, like his hair.
"Dumbledore!" he called heartily as he walked up the slope. "How are you, my dear fellow? How are you?"
"Blooming, thank you, Professor Karkaroff,"
Dumbledore replied. Karkaroff had a fruity, unctuous voice. When he stepped into the light pouring from the front doors of the castle, they saw that he was tall and thin, like Dumbledore, but his white hair was short, and his goatee, finishing in a small curl, did not entirely hide his rather weak chin. When he reached Dumbledore, he shook hands with both of his own.
"Dear old Hogwarts," he said,
looking up at the castle and smiling. His teeth were rather yellow, and Harry noticed that his smile did not extend to his eyes, which remained cold and shrewd.
"How good it is to be here! How good! Victor, come along into the warmth! You don't mind, Dumbledore? Victor has a slight head cold."
Karkaroff beckoned forward one of his students. As the boy passed, Harry caught a glimpse of a prominent curved nose and thick black eyebrows. He didn't need the punch on the arm Ron gave him or the hiss in his ear to recognize that profile.
"Harry, it's Crumb."
Chapter 16. The Goblet of Fire.
"I don't believe it,"
Ron said in a stunned voice as the Hogwarts students filed back up the steps behind the party from Durmstrang.
"Crumb, Harry! Victor Crumb!"
"For heaven's sake, Ron, he's only a Quidditch player," said Hermione.
"Only a Quidditch player?"
Ron said, looking at her as though he couldn't believe his ears.
"Hermione, he's one of the best seekers in the world. I had no idea he was still at school."
As they recrossed the entrance hall with the rest of the Hogwarts students heading for the Great Hall, Harry saw Lee Jordan jumping up and down on the soles of his feet to get a better look at the back of Crumb's head. Several sixth-year girls were frantically searching their pockets as they walked.
"Oh, I don't believe it. I haven't got a single quill on me."
"Do you think he's signed my hat in lipstick?"
"Really?"
Hermione said loftily as they passed the girls, now squabbling over the lipstick.
"I'm getting his autograph if I can,"
said Ron.
"You haven't got a quill, have you, Harry?"
"Nope. They're upstairs in my bag,"
said Harry. They walked over to the Gryffindor table and sat down. Ron took care to sit on the side facing the doorway, because Crumb and his fellow Durmstrang students were still gathered around it, apparently unsure about where they should sit. The students from Beauxbatons had chosen seats at the Ravenclaw table. They were looking around the great hall with glum expressions on their faces. Three of them were still clutching scarves and shawls around their heads.
"It's not that cold,"
said Hermione defensively.
"Why didn't they bring cloaks?"
"Over here. Come and sit over here,"
Ron hissed.
"Over here.
Hermione, budge up. Make a space."
"What? Too late,"
said Ron bitterly. Victor Crumb and his fellow Durmstrang students had settled themselves at the Slytherin table. Harry could see Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle looking very smug about this. As he watched, Malfoy bent forward to speak to Crumb.
"Yeah, that's right. Smarm up to him, Malfoy,"
said Ron scathingly.
"I bet Crumb can see right through him, though. Bet he gets people fawning over him all the time. Where do you reckon they're going to sleep?"
"We could offer him a space in our dormitory, Harry. I wouldn't mind giving him my bed. I could kip on a camp bed."
Hermione snorted. "They look a lot happier than the Beauxbatons lot," said Harry. The Durmstrang students were pulling off their heavy furs and looking up at the starry black ceiling with expressions of interest. A couple of them were picking up the golden plates and goblets and examining them, apparently impressed.
Up at the staff table, Filch, the caretaker, was adding chairs. He was wearing his mouldy old tailcoat in honour of the occasion. Harry was surprised to see that he added four chairs, two on either side of Dumbledore's. Hey? Said Ron, vaguely. He was still staring avidly at Crumb. When all the students had entered the hall and settled down at their house tables, the staff entered, filing up to the top table and taking their seats. Last in line were Professor Dumbledore, Professor Karkaroff, and Madame Maxime. When their headmistress appeared, the pupils from Beaubaton leapt to their feet. A few of the Hogwarts students laughed. The Beaubaton party appeared quite unembarrassed, however, and did not resume their seats until Madame Maxime had sat down on Dumbledore's left-hand side. Dumbledore remained standing, and a silence fell over the great hall.
"Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, ghosts, and most particularly guests," said Dumbledore, beaming around at the foreign students. "I have great pleasure in welcoming you all to Hogwarts. I hope and trust that your stay here will be both comfortable and enjoyable."
One of the Beaubaton girls, still clutching a muffler around her head, gave what was unmistakably a derisive laugh.
"No one's making you stay,"
Hermione whispered, bristling at her.
"The tournament will be officially opened at the end of the feast," said Dumbledore. "I now invite you all to eat, drink, and make yourselves at home."
He sat down, and Harry saw Karkaroff lean forward at once and engage him in conversation. The plates in front of them filled with food as usual. The house elves in the kitchen seemed to have pulled out all the stops. There was a greater variety of dishes in front of them than Harry had ever seen, including several that were definitely foreign.
"What's that?"
said Ron, pointing at a large dish of some sort of shellfish stew that stood beside a large steak and kidney pudding.
"Bouillabaisse,"
said Hermione.
"Bless you," said Ron. "It's French," said Hermione. "I had it on holiday summer before last. It's very nice."
"I'll take your word for it," said Ron, helping himself to black pudding. The great hall seemed somehow much more crowded than usual, even though there were barely 20 additional students there. Perhaps it was because their differently coloured uniforms stood out so clearly against the black of the Hogwarts robes. Now that they had removed their furs, the Durmstrang students were revealed to be wearing robes of a deep blood red. Hagrid sidled into the hall through a door behind the staff table 20 minutes after the start of the feast. He slid into his seat at the end and waved at Harry, Ron and Hermione with a very heavily bandaged hand.
"Scroot's doing all right, Hagrid?"
Harry called.
"Driving!"
Hagrid called back happily.
"Yeah, I'll just bet they are," said Ron quietly. "Looks like they've finally found a food they like, doesn't it? Hagrid's fingers."
At that moment, a voice said,
"Excuse me, are you wanting the bouillabaisse?"
It was the girl from Beaubaton who had laughed during Dumbledore's speech. She had finally removed her muffler. A long sheet of silvery blonde hair fell almost to her waist. She had large, deep blue eyes and very white, even teeth. Ron went purple. He stared up at her, opened his mouth to reply, but nothing came out except a faint gurgling noise. "Yeah, have it," said Harry, pushing the dish toward the girl.
"You have finished with it?"
"Yeah,"
Ron said breathlessly.
"Yeah, it was excellent."
The girl picked up the dish and carried it carefully off to the Ravenclaw table. Ron was still goggling at the girl as though he had never seen one before. Harry started to laugh. The sound seemed to jog Ron back to his senses.
"She's a Veiler," he said hoarsely to Harry.
"Of course she isn't," said Hermione tartly. "I don't see anyone else gaping at her like an idiot."
But she wasn't entirely right about that.
As the girl crossed the hall, many boys' heads turned, and some of them seemed to have become temporarily speechless, just like Ron.
"I'm telling you, that's not a normal girl," said Ron,
leaning sideways so he could keep a clear view of her.
"They don't make them like that at Hogwarts."
"They make them okay at Hogwarts," said Harry without thinking. Cho happened to be sitting only a few places away from the girl with the silvery hair.
"When you've both put your eyes back in," said Hermione briskly, "you'll be able to see who's just arrived."
She was pointing up at the staff table. The two remaining empty seats had just been filled. Ludo Bagman was now sitting on Professor Karkaroff's other side, while Mr. Crouch, Percy's boss, was next to Madame Maxime.
"What are they doing here?" said Harry in surprise.
"They organized the Triwizard Tournament, didn't they?" said Hermione. "I suppose they wanted to be here to see it start."
When the second course arrived, they noticed a number of unfamiliar desserts, too. Ron examined an odd sort of pale blancmange closely, then moved it carefully a few inches to his right so that it would be clearly visible from the Ravenclaw table. The girl, who looked like a Vela, appeared to have eaten enough, however, and did not come over to get it. Once the golden plates had been wiped clean, Dumbledore stood up again. A pleasant sort of tension seemed to fill the hall now. Harry felt a slight thrill of excitement, wondering what was coming. Several seats down from them, Fred and George were leaning forward, staring at Dumbledore with great concentration.
"The moment has come,"
said Dumbledore, smiling around at the sea of upturned faces.
"The Triwizard Tournament is about to start. I would like to say a few words of explanation before we bring in the casket."
"The what?" Harry muttered. Ron shrugged.
"Just to clarify the procedure that we will be following this year. But first, let me introduce, for those who do not know them, Mr. Bartemius Crouch, head of the Department of International Magical Cooperation."
There was a smattering of polite applause.
"And Mr. Ludo Bagman, head of the Department of Magical Games and Sports."
There was a much louder round of applause for Bagman than for Crouch, perhaps because of his fame as a beater, or simply because he looked so much more likable. He acknowledged it with a jovial wave of his hand. Bartemius Crouch did not smile or wave when his name was announced. Remembering him in his neat suit at the Quidditch World Cup, Harry thought he looked strange in wizard's robes. His toothbrush moustache and severe parting looked very odd next to Dumbledore's long white hair and beard.
"Mr. Bagman and Mr. Crouch have worked tirelessly over the last few months on the arrangements for the Triwizard Tournament," Dumbledore continued, "and they will be joining myself, Professor Karkaroff, and Madame Maxime on the panel that will judge the champions' efforts."
At the mention of the word champions, the attentiveness of the listening students seemed to sharpen. Perhaps Dumbledore had noticed their sudden stillness, for he smiled as he said,
"The casket, then, if you please, Mr. Filch."
Filch, who had been lurking unnoticed in a far corner of the hall, now approached Dumbledore carrying a great wooden chest encrusted with jewels. It looked extremely old. A murmur of excited interest rose from the watching students. Dennis Creevy actually stood on his chair to see it properly, but, being so tiny, his head hardly rose above anyone else's.
"The instructions for the task the champions will face this year have already been examined by Mr. Crouch and Mr. Bagman," said Dumbledore, as Filch placed the chest carefully on the table before him, "and they have made the necessary arrangements for each challenge. There will be 3 tasks spaced throughout the school year, and they will test the champions in many different ways: their magical prowess, their daring, their powers of deduction, and, of course, their ability to cope with danger."
At this last word, the hall was filled with a silence so absolute that nobody seemed to be breathing.
"As you know, 3 champions compete in the tournament,"
Dumbledore went on calmly.
"One
from each of the participating schools. They will be marked on how well they perform each of the tournament tasks, and the champion with the highest total after task 3 will win the Tri-Wizard Cup. The champions will be chosen by an impartial selector, the Goblet of Fire.
Dumbledore now took out his wand and tapped 3 times upon the top of the casket. The lid creaked slowly open. Dumbledore reached inside it and pulled out a large, roughly hewn wooden cup. It would have been entirely unremarkable had it not been full to the brim with dancing blue-white flames. Dumbledore closed the casket and placed the goblet carefully on top of it, where it would be clearly visible to everyone in the hall.
"Anybody wishing to submit themselves as champion must write their name and school clearly upon